Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Hello everyone and welcome to a special edition of the Spanish Football Podcast. I'm Phil Kitramelides, joined as ever by Sid Lowe. Hello Sidney.
Hello Phil, how are you?
I'm good my friend and I'm excited because we've got a special guest. It's someone we've wanted to have on the podcast for a while and we finally made it happen and we thought it would be a good time to make it happen ahead of El Clásico. Gary Lineker's on the podcast. Gary, welcome to TSFP.
Great to be on. Regular listener, of course.
Well, that's the... It's
you. Right. You're the one.
Hey, there you go. I think actually I doubled your numbers when I started.
Yeah, it did. Yeah.
Appreciate that. Thanks for the support. So we've got lots of stuff we want to ask you. Obviously, with El Clásico, we're going to reflect on your time at Barcelona and your memories of the fixture. I wanted to start off by asking you about this fixture because, you know, for us, it's still pretty special. We don't have the little Argentine magician. We don't have the big Portuguese goal-scoring machine here anymore. Maybe a little bit of the stardust has dropped off. But for us, it still retains a special nature. And from a external position, someone who doesn't necessarily live and work in Spain or in Spanish football, for you, is it still a special fixture, El Clásico, when it comes around?
Oh, absolutely. I think in world football, it's probably the biggest club game. And still is, and probably always will be. Even, you know, stars come and go, but the two clubs remain the same. It's a hugely important fixture for both, I would say. And it's unique in many ways, you know, because of the history of the two sides, because it's not a derby game as such, even though when I was there, they used to call it El Derby, and which always struck me as a bit odd because it was, you know, it's about an hour flight. So so it was, but it, yeah, it's a huge game. Yes, no Messi, no Ronaldo now, but you've got, you know, there's Bellingham and the young superstars coming up at Barcelona. And we'll have probably Mbappe next season as well. Vinicius Jr. And so there's plenty to enjoy.
It's interesting that you said that. And it's music to my ears hearing you say it will still be the biggest club game probably forever. In the Spanish press, I noticed they've been bigging up Manchester City against Liverpool in recent years, and I've seen it being called the new Clásico, El Nuevo Clásico, Manchester City, Liverpool, but that will never have the same, you know, history and meaning that this fixture has, right?
Well, you can't just invent things just because two teams are playing well for a few seasons, and we all know that will probably change when Klopp and eventually, which will happen, Pep walks away. So I think that's a... You can't suddenly go, oh, it would, before it was, you know, Liverpool and Manchester United, and before that it was Chelsea and Man United, and then you can't keep changing. Whereas that fixture, you know, we probably, I think a fairer comparison is a proper derby. It's Liverpool, Everton, the Manchester derby, the North London derby possibly, but it's a different feel, the Clásico. And even to this day, and things have changed, and obviously financially the Premier League is much, much richer than La Liga. But if you look at the bigger picture, the superstars, the world's best players, the great players, still go to La Liga. They go to Barcelona or Real Madrid. And that's, you know, that has not really changed. I don't think you know, the Premier League has really signed an absolute superstar until possibly Haaland, but he was quite young. Pogba was a thought, but he's not quite lived up to those expectations. But the absolute superstars, you know, that we've seen at Real Madrid and Barcelona for many years now, it still seems to be the place that they want to go.
Speaking of superstars signing for the big two in Spain, obviously this starts in 1986 when Barcelona signed the world's best player. There's another component to this, obviously, and you know this is a thing that I bang on about a lot, is that there's no other game that has the kind of the meaning, the symbolism, the kind of the social and cultural and political significance that this derby has. When you went to Barcelona, how long did it take you to kind of become aware of that? Of that this was more than, to use the cliche, this was more than a game?
About 12 minutes. it gets driven into you from the very start. It's all they ever talk about in many ways, in terms of as soon as you get there, that thing. And to be perfectly frank, everyone knew who Barcelona and Real Madrid were as teams even before I went. But once I got there... Yes, you do. I remember speaking to directors before I actually arrived in Barcelona when I met them in London, telling me the significance and the fact that, you know, it was Real Madrid is seen as Franco's team, and that the only place that you could speak Catalan at one point was in the stadium. Some of them, you know, one of the directors says, I was in jail for that. And it was so, you know, there's that history, which is obviously why they probably call it Mezquion Club. And it's, you know, it's because it's more than just about football to them. It was, you know, so yes, that gets, you know, you learn that very quickly when you arrive in Barcelona. I think it's possibly more important to Barcelona than Real Madrid, perhaps the political aspect of it, as you would expect. I don't know, because I didn't play for Real Madrid, but it's something that you learn very quickly, and you understand the significance in many ways goes beyond football.
The other thing in this, obviously, that's the build up to it. To actually play in it, was it different to the other games? The actual experience of playing the match itself?
Massively different, Sid. Massively different, certainly in terms of the atmosphere. I mean, I arrived at the Camp Nou, as you said, in 86, which is way beyond the date of really good footballers arriving at Barcelona. And I played in a number of games in the Camp Nou, and I used to think to myself, the atmosphere's a little bit flat. I expected it to be kind of more volatile and loud, but it was actually it was kind of like a middle class audience. It was as though it seemed like you were at the opera. They're kind of waiting for something to happen, and then they'll give you polite applause, or if they don't like it, they'll sort of wave white handkerchiefs and pañuelos blancos and whistle. And it seemed to be down to you to entertain them rather than get them to get you up. And I thought, well, it's missing of the atmosphere that we had in England. But then it was January or February when I played in the first Clásico in Barcelona. I'd already played at the Bernabeu, but this talking about Camp Nou now. And it was like, wow, it was a totally different thing. The atmosphere was incredible. And the other massive difference to English football, certainly then, I know it's changed a little bit, but I didn't get any away fans. You didn't get any away fans in the ground. So in the Camp Nou then held 120,000 people. And pretty much every single one of them was a Barcelona fan. If there's a Real Madrid fan in there, they'd have kept them, they'd have been quiet. And the roar and the noise when you came out the tunnel, and I scored two in the first 5 minutes, and I know it's taken me a long time to get round to my hat trick, yep. But I thought we should cover it.
Yeah, and show a little bit of decency and restraint.
Yeah, I was holding back. And I scored two in the first 5 minutes, and I have never, ever in my life experienced a noise or an atmosphere or a feeling like it. I had goosebumps on my body. It was like, I mean, 120,000 people. That's like times two of a normal big game in this country. So, I mean, it was just... And everyone was on your side. The interesting thing was this... because we went three up in that game, when Real Madrid scored, I thought it had been disallowed because there was no noise. There was not a single cheer, possibly except for in the Balco with one of the El Presidente of Real Madrid or something. But aside from that, you could hear a pin drop, and I thought, oh, I must have been offside. Oh, no, it's a goal because there's no away fans. But that, yeah, it's very different to the other games there. It's like with the other games, I think they expect you to win. And also, they expect you to entertain them before they get excited.
So they do get excited because you score a hat-trick. What's the fallout of from that like? I mean, how have you got reporters on your doorstep? Have you got kind of a sense that for the following week that everyone's all over you, that you've done something truly historic? I was going through the list of people who scored hat-tricks. I think I've only come up with seven in total.
It's a decent
history.
List. I've got them.
It's a pretty good list. I've gone.
Well, there's six, I think there's 16 in all competitions, not just La Liga. I'm not going to go through all of them, but
it's got to be La Liga. Come on, it's got to be in the league.
Oh well, cup game's no good.
A cup game's no good. Okay, well, Vinicius is out then, I think. But there's some really good names in there, and obviously Gary is one of them. So yeah, what's the fallout?
It was a massive change, not just in terms of how I was, I think, received at Barcelona and I think recognised then and accepted more than ever before. I'd done all right up until then. I was going okay, but that completely changed things. They're not the kind of people that go and stand out your front door. I never had that, and I don't think that's probably changed. I hope not. People were always respectful. I never got, you know, they didn't bother you quite as much as they did when I was here. But after that game, there was obviously massive recognition. It was the first time as well that I'd been at Barcelona where there was a British press contingent that came out for that game. So so I kind of did a press conference in the Princess Sophia after the game for all the Brit pack. And they were much more likely to doorstep me than the Spanish press were. and the other thing I loved in my time in Barcelona is they weren't interested in your private life like they were. It was like, oh, wow, you haven't got to sneak out if you want to go anywhere, or if you're going to have a night out, no one's going to report you, or you're not going to read about that in the newspapers or anything like that. It was more enjoyable in that way. But things definitely changed after that point. I mean, to do that was a game changer for me. It was I didn't sleep that night after the game.
Just going back to sort of the cultural differences that you touched upon. Obviously, you arrive at Barcelona, and there is an English manager there. Did that help you, Terry Venables? Did that help your assimilation, or was it still a big thing? You know, this is really, really different. How everything is done here is so different. Or did Terry Venables being there help that?
I think it was probably a nice little precursor to it. And he was just there a season and a little bit. And we became very close, actually, friends, which is really unusual in football to have like a relationship with a coach. I don't think that would have happened ever in English football. And funnily enough, Terry became my coach at Tottenham when I went back to England, and we didn't have that kind of relationship that we had in Barcelona. I think it was very unusual because we'd go out to lunch together, we'd have dinner together sometimes, you know, with our partners. And, you know, Mark Hughes had come along, and that's a bit of an English, but I don't know where, I always wonder how perhaps the Spanish players, what they thought about that, whether they even knew. Perhaps they did, I don't know. But it was unusual, and I think it helped. But I also I really wanted to try and settle in and let, you know, sort of feel the culture, learn the language. So I went to school 3 days a week for 2 years, actually, to learn Spanish, which I think was a really important thing because... not Catalan, because the dressing room was Spanish spoken in there, really, because not all the players were from Catalonia, obviously. So it was a Spanish speaking dressing room. So I learned that language, and then I think that helped. It helps you settle in, and then you become, you know, friends with the players. You can converse properly without going through an interpreter. Even though we had a very good interpreter in Graham Turner. Graham, as he used to call it. Graham.
Graham.
And so, yeah, I think that was important. But it was culturally different in many ways, but in good ways. Siestas. Whoa, how good are they? We used to go, I mean, what a life. You'd train in the morning, in the sunshine, usually. In the sunshine, not on very good facilities, I have to say, at that point, because yeah. Barcelona used to train on the pitch that was right next to the new camp, and now is part of the car park.
Yeah, it was next to between La Masia and the new
next
camp.
To La Masia. Yeah. Next to La Masia, that's yeah. right. And it wasn't even really a full-size pitch, and it was sandy, and it was hopeless, really. I mean, now they've got this incredible setup with their, you know, the whole training ground stuff, but... back then, so we had that was like next door. So you a couple of hours in the morning, then you go home. We'd go to the beach club and have a little bit of lunch, like a nice paella and some lovely seafood. And then you go home. We get home about 5-6 o'clock, and it's about 2 or 3 hours kick. Ooh, 2 or 3 hours, and then you go out. I mean, it's pointless trying to go out in Spain back then. It's changed a little bit. It's a bit earlier now, but it's still much later than London. So then we'd go out for dinner around 10, 10.30 at night, because there'd be no one in a restaurant before 10 o'clock. And then you end up kind of getting home at 1 or 2, and so you split your sleep. I mean, what a lifestyle. Why wouldn't anyone love that? In one of the most beautiful cities in the world. And it was, so let's say it was different culturally, and you obviously, you know, certainly in the early days when you can't talk to people properly. It was a little bit difficult, and you're feeling your way. We lived in a hotel for 4 months before we found a little villa, and so it was difficult, but difficult in a lovely, lovely way. I mean, and everyone was super helpful.
Just pick up on Terry a little bit. There's obviously there's been a huge amount of discussion over the last, I would say certainly post Cruyff, but in particular it kind of re-emerged in the Guardiola era, and it's now something that Xavi and Luis Enrique have been talking about this week. This whole argument about Barcelona's identity and its DNA and what it is that really makes Barcelona. Is there a sense for you at least that some of what Terry did to change things has been overlooked? Some of the kind of the tactical innovations, the very, very high press, the being very, very aggressive with the ball. Because, you know, this is a guy that leads Barcelona, admittedly just before you get there, but I'm sure they're still doing some of the same things when you are there, leads Barcelona to a first league title in 13 years, I think it is, maybe 14. You know, he was genuinely different, right?
Very much so. And he didn't even come with a particularly English style, really. I mean, you know, he's playing this high line, high press. And I think when he first came in the first few games, Terry said to me that they thought, what the hell is this? What are we trying to do here? But, I mean, he ran away with the league, battered Real Madrid in the Bernabeu, and transformed things. It was a shame, really, that he got fired when he did. I think about 4 or 5 games into the season with, like, won one, drawn one, lost one or something. That was about it. It wasn't like the worst start in the history of football. So, but yeah, Terry was, I mean, he was ahead of his time, coaching-wise, Terry. There's no question about that. I think ultimately the biggest change and the biggest influence on Barcelona is has to be Johan Cruyff. I mean, he changed the way that the game was played at the club, and the way they thought in the academies and... in La Masia, etc. So I think so. But I mean, whenever I go back, the old, you have to be of a certain age, of course, to remember Terry's time at the club and my time at the club. But a lot of people do, and they always remember him very, very fondly, and tactically very clever, which he was. And the players had a massive amount of respect for him, I could tell that.
Your hat trick, which is the very end of January 1987, Two weeks later, you go and stick 4 past Spain at the Bernabeu for England. So at that point, is there a kind of a sense in Spain and I suppose in your own mind of, bloody hell, this guy's quite good?
Well, to be honest, it was only around that stage that because I always thought I was blagging it a bit, really. I thought I was getting, you know, because I wasn't like Messi.
Welcome to our world, Gary.
Well, that's it, you know.
I know the feeling.
You know, I'd scored loads of goals, but I wasn't like a... you know, the kind of player that could dribble past two or three people and knock it in the top corner, or have long range efforts. I just kind of worked out how to score goals by movement and gambling on space. So, you know, so but around this stage, in fact, that is the very game. And I remember scoring my fourth goal in the Bernabeu to make it 4-2. I'm running back to the halfway line. Brian Robson's running alongside me. And I turned to him and I went, "Rob, why am I so lucky?" Didn't you? And he turned to me and he just went, "Oh, fuck off." Which I thought was quite a nice riposte. But even that game was special as well, because we flew over with the Barcelona players. I met the England team in Madrid, because it would have been mad to me to go to London and then come out with them. So I met them there. So I flew on the little hop from Barcelona to Madrid with, like, I don't know, half a dozen Barcelona players, including the goalkeeper, Andoni Zubizarreta. And they were giving me loads of shit. How are we going to do it? You know, the usual banter. I mean, it's just the same. That doesn't change anywhere in the world that I've played in, honestly. The dressing room banter and the mickey taking is just the same. So we go and play the game. And obviously Terry Venables was still then the coach of Barcelona. And Terry's Spanish was pretty good. It was acceptable. You know, it was grammatically, he struggled a little bit. A bit like his English, some would say. But he obviously sometimes they picked up a few English bits and stuff, the players that I played with. So we play in the game and we win 4-2. And I go in the dressing room at the end of the match and I'm sitting there thinking, oh my God. And Andoni Zubizarreta comes in our dressing room, and he just came up to me and he just came, looked at me and he went, "Fucking hell," in a perfect Cockney accent. bless him. He was a great guy. Subi. But that was one hell of a month. But my best bit about it, was the next morning. You know, the Sport,
yeah,
the newspaper in Barcelona, the local newspaper. The headline on that paper was my favourite headline ever: "Catalan player scores 4 against Spain."
So there you are. This is the perfect embodiment of what the Clásico is. That you know, even when Spain,
exactly.
Here we go. Here's your Barcelona man has done this for us. Yeah, it's brilliant. Yeah. You know, you mentioned
they say always look for a local angle.
Yeah,
said,
there's
right,
always a local angle. Yeah, there always is.
Gotta be.
You mentioned Cruyff, and it's kind of an awkward one, I suppose, for you personally, isn't it? That Cruyff is this great revolutionary figure, but he's also the one that kind of ends it for you.
At Boston, yes, he did. And I get it, though. Don't forget, in those days, you only allowed 2 foreign players in your starting lineup. And a new coach comes in. You get it that he probably wants his own foreign players. He wants his own 2. He just rather than just the 2 that are already there. So I also started that season with hepatitis. So I didn't play until, I don't know, late October, November, something like that. And eventually I got in the starting lineup and he played me on the wing. Now, I worked it out straight away. There's no way I shouldn't have been playing centre forward in that team. I mean, Julio Salinas was a very good goal scorer, a lovely guy, I love him to bits. But he didn't have my record. And the way his team and the football that he played, I would have been perfect for the number 9 in that particular tactical state. But I think he just wanted his own foreign player, and his plan was play me out of position. I'll moan. The public will go, "Here's another footballer moaning about his position," and blah blah blah. And I'll ask for a transfer. But I kind of saw that. I saw what was going on. So I thought, well, I'm not. I'll just play the game. I'll just play on the right wing. Get on with it. It's quite easy playing on the wing. Boring, but easy. All you got to do is go bosh, bosh. God, that was quite quick. Knock it, cross it. Knock it, cross. I mean, I got no satisfaction. Hardly scored any goals at all that season. Ruined my goal scoring ratio at Barcelona and generally. So it was a difficult season for me. I absolutely admit it. But in the end, because I kept my calm and I just got on with it, I was professional, I kept playing out of position, just did what he asked me to do. I played most of the games. He substituted me too quite a few times at half time. I think he was just trying to rile me so that I'd be the one that goes into the club and go, "I want to leave." What he should have done was come to me at the at the very start, say, Gary, I'm not sure you fit into my plans. We'll get you a move. He says, we've only got two foreign players. I kind of want, you know, Ronald Koeman or, you know, someone, whoever you want to get it. And I'd have gone, no problem. That's absolutely fine. I understand. But that's not how it works in football. That never happens.
No.
That never, ever happens. So we went through this rigmarole for a year. But in that year, I learned a lot, a hell of a lot, because even, you know, he was an unbelievable player, but he was also an incredible coach. I learned so much from his training sessions and how he was and how when we got the ball, you've got to make it as pitch as big as you possibly can. And when you've not got the ball, try and make it small as you can. How to use space, how it was a lot of possession football, 7 against 5, 9 against 7, 4 against 3, all these kind of different ways. And he was a know-it-all, Johan. He was not just about football, but about everything in life. He was, let's say, he didn't lack confidence. I spent most of my time just kind of really concentrating on what he was talking about, because he knew the game like, you know, him and Terry Venables were incredible coaches.
On the face of it, for those of us who haven't played football and haven't been involved in the game, it feels almost strange to imagine a scenario in which, in this case you, but it's like any professional footballer, but in this case you, a guy who's been to the World Cup, a guy who's played in England, is playing in Spain, has worked under lots of different managers, been hugely successful. It seems almost inconceivable that a manager can turn up and show you something that you'd never considered before, that you'd never thought about, that you'd never seen. I don't even know what the question is in a way. I suppose the question is how? How can you have a manager who sees, how can you not have seen something? Or how can a manager see something that a whole load of players haven't?
It's still happening. Look what Pep's doing. He's reinventing the game every year. You know, he started with inverted fullbacks and stuff, and people say, well, that sort of thing would have happened a little bit. Would it? Really? Did it? Now we're seeing central defender coming in and playing like all over the pitch, like John Stones is doing. And people drop in for him and stuff. So the game will constantly, it's a little bit like fashion, isn't it? It goes around, comes around. But I think there are certain people that have incredible minds for the game that see things like, I always saw the game through a centre forward's eye. That was all I thought about constantly, even before I go to bed at night, when I wake up in the morning. All I'm thinking about is how to score goals, how to do this, how to do that. I didn't think of the game as beyond that. Whereas there are people that do. There's a load of coaches, some of them I've played for, some of them I've watched over the years, that basically go along familiar lines. They're very good at organising a certain way of playing, but do they reinvent the game? No. But someone like Cruyff, and I would say I'd put Terry Venables in there as well, because the what he brought to Spanish football when he arrived at Barcelona. But Cruyff was something else. He was incredibly intelligent and inventive. And I think that's the difference. I know you can think, well, footballers should know all the different systems and how to play in certain positions, and everyone should be able to play in every position. That was the whole ethos, wasn't it, that came out of the Dutch football, total football and stuff. Everyone should be able to play everywhere. But he kind of proved that in a way. Not that although he probably failed when he put me on the right wing, but apart from that, he did all right. But no, it was incredible. I always have massive respect. You know, I was irritated by it. It was a difficult year. I got it though. I understood it. But would I swap that year and how much I learned about football from it? No.
Obviously, after Barcelona was kind of like a stepping stone to reach the pinnacle of football, which is obviously playing for Tottenham Hotspur Football Club, and any professional will agree, I'm sure. So you came back to England after this, you know, really enriching experience away, won a few trophies, learnt a lot, scored some goals, learnt the language, and then you were back in England. My question is, you know, you went away and you weren't necessarily a pioneer, but there weren't too many English players that had played in Spain before you. or since? So why is it that there aren't that many English players to have made the leap and come to Spain or even abroad that much?
Well, we're starting to see a little bit of a change, aren't we? One or two of our younger players are going now for the experience. And back in my day, though, it was mostly in Italy that they went. You know, there were, as you say, there wasn't the numbers like there are now, but the game's kind of become more global, hasn't it? Everyone's moving around and it's not... But yeah, it was kind of a bit of an upheaval in some ways. I'm still a post-war the only Englishman to play for Barcelona. There's obviously a couple of the girls have played for Barcelona women, but I'm the only English man. Obviously, Mark Hughes was Welsh, Steve Archibald was Scottish. I kind of like that. I just hope they don't sign, you know, go and get Harry Kane in a couple of years' time or something. But no, I don't mind. But yeah, it's a mad statistic that, isn't it? All the time. I mean, Real Madrid have had loads of, by comparison, English players, obviously. But yeah, I'm the only one. Yeah, it's nuts.
They've got a good one now, Real Madrid, in terms of English players in Jude Bellingham. Just kind of want to get your thoughts on him as a player and how he's developed over this year and how impressive he's been.
Beyond impressive, really. To do that in your first season, to almost become the leader of a club like Real Madrid. Real Madrid, for crying out loud, to go in.
Yeah, it's not like he's turned up to be rubbish, is it? He's turned up at the biggest club of all.
You know, he's so young still, yet so mature. You know, even the way he handles himself, how the things he says after the game in his interviews, he's incredibly articulate, very intelligent. You can see that on the field of play. But his all round game is just superb. I've met him a couple of times, and he's humble. But he's also driven. He's really driven. And you can see he's the kind of player that will lift the team when they really need it. Get them out of a hole when they really need it. He'll never give up. You know, he can do it all. He can put in a tackle. He can chase back. He's brilliant. I mean, I love watching him play. And he's not afraid to try a trick and a turn and a twist and a little back heel and a flick. He's also quite adept at scoring a very late important goal in a game. He's done numerous times for Real Madrid this season. I feel almost ashamed to say that I've kind of at sometimes cheered a Real Madrid goal because it's him, which is a really peculiar feeling because as anyone who's played for Barcelona, you just don't want Real Madrid to do well, but I want him to do well. So it's been strange. It's been a difficult few months for me. Hope your thoughts are with me at this difficult time.
Yeah, absolutely. Is your ideal Clásico result then a 4-3 Barcelona win in which Bellingham gets a hat-trick that ultimately doesn't matter? Or would you rather that another Englishman doesn't get
well, a hat-trick? Well, that's quite a good thing, point there, Sid. That's a good point. I was just going to say he can get two, okay?
Yeah, okay, fair enough.
I don't think another Englishman has scored a hat-trick either in a Clásico. So let's just two will do, okay, Jude?
He got two last time, didn't he?
He did. He got two last time. In fact, it was Benzema, wasn't it? Got a hat-trick season two ago. It was the first European since me to score a hat-trick in the Clásico. I hate bigging myself up like this, but it's my own, that hat-trick is my only claim to fame, really.
You've said something earlier. I feel the need to pick up on this. You know, now that we're talking about this, you just said... playing on the right wing's easy. So does this mean we got to throw everything that Lionel Messi did away? You know, it's easy, Leo. All you farting around on the right wing.
It's unfathomable what he does. I mean, I mean Messi at Barcelona was... I mean, some of the years there, well, most of the years there. I mean, just extraordinary. Game after game, he was just incredible. I mean, I don't think... I mean, a lot of people in the game understand how breathtakingly good he is, but it's hard to work out how he does the things that he does. I'm not just talking about the goals, because people will go, but he's got about the same amount of goals as so-and-so or Ronaldo and all that. It's not about that. It's about the things he does that are not possible. And he'll do three or four of those things at least in every game, where he'll be just in a little pocket where there's about five players around him. You think, hey, there's no way out of there. And it's like, and then he's, you go, how? How? And I played at the top level. And I know other people that have played at the top level. And you just go, how? And he's the best dribbler I've ever seen, along with possibly Diego. I think he's the only comparison. But he's also the best passer of a football I've ever seen. He sees things that you can't see. Even I remember sitting watching a Champions League game. I think it was the one which eventually they lost the second leg against Liverpool. You know, the mad comeback. Mm. And we were watching the games with Rio. And we, you know, you're right up in the gods when you, you know what it's like up in that press thing there. So.
Yeah.
And we're looking down and he sees a pass that we couldn't see looking at the whole picture. And you go, and we, I remember we both turned to each other and we just went, how do you do that? And he continues to do that all the time. He just, it takes your breath away. And he's, I'm so glad I've experienced watching him in my life since I finished playing, because he's given me, you know, almost two decades of absolute joy. And it's obviously he's kind of semi-retired now, along with as has Cristiano, but they would admit that, but we know what it is. I did it myself. I would never ever compare myself ever with Lionel Messi, other than the fact that I did stand in the same area of the pitch for a little while.
But you ran in very straight lines.
Very straight lines, no jinking. And there was no point whatsoever where any one of the 120,000 Barcelona fans, when I was surrounded by four players, have ever gone, how did he get out of that? Because he never did. He would have just given the ball away. Or fallen over, probably.
In all of this, there's one other thing I wanted to ask you about from a kind of a purely footballing point of view. You were talking earlier about learning how to score goals. And I can't remember when it was, but you mentioned this once before, that learning from watching people, and in particular from watching Hugo Sanchez, that you're sort of seeing things that, in terms of where to be, that you maybe wouldn't have contemplated if you hadn't seen other people do it.
Yeah, Hugo Sanchez was at Real Madrid at the time, for younger people that don't know. He's a Mexican striker, very diminutive, but unbelievably athletic and gym, kind of, I think his sister was like an Olympic gymnast or something. You could see, and he used to score overhead kicks like four or five a season. You saw how. Yeah. He was so agile that he'd deliberately take a player in, he'd come out to the far post, take the defender in a bit, and then wait for a long cross and turn his back on the defender and then do these incredible bicycle kicks. That's not what I learned, because all I'd have learned from that is how to break my back. What I did learn from him was his move is from corner kicks. And I think he added three or four goals a season onto my my repertoire, because I watched him. I watched him really closely in all the games. And his movement was kind of similar to mine in lots of ways, except for that thing about taking people to the far post. I was more of a near postman. But at corner kicks, he'd stand on the goalkeeper. And as it came over, because you used to have one defender one side, the goalkeeper the other. And if the defender tried to get in front of him, he would back up 2 yards. If the defender tried to get behind him, he'd come forward 2 yards. And basically, all he'd find himself was a yard or two of space at a corner kick. And then someone would either flick it on at the near post, and he's there, and he's got like a tap in. And I thought, God, he does that. And I watched it and I watched it. It was a very, very easy thing to do to add to my game. And you get kind of like on the half turn. And if it's headed down, you get a really good chance. Prime example, and it was probably the most Hugo Sanchez goal I scored in my career. It was a corner for England when we were, I think we had to draw against Poland to qualify for the 1992 Euros. And David Rocastle knocked in a corner. Somebody headed it. And I'd done exactly that. I'd just pulled off a couple of yards and kind of scissor kicked it. I wouldn't describe it as a bicycle kick. I'd call it a scissor kick. But it was purely from him, watching him. So you can always learn, even when you're in a specialist position, which a centre forward is. But Hugo was fantastic. And I saw him recently at the the museum kind of in Madrid, and he was there, and they, because I didn't get the match ball in the Clásico, they did some research and said that, well, they found one, but it's certainly the same kind of ball. If it was the same ball that I actually scored the three goals with, I'd be sort of staggered. But nevertheless, he played in that game, Hugo. So he very kindly signed it for me. So that's, which feels very special, because I think he was the best of my time.
He's still the holder of the most ridiculous record in football, I think. When he scored in the 1989-90 season, 38 goals, all with one touch. No one's ever going to do that again. I mean, that's just a ridiculous record. Unbelievable.
His first touch is a finish because he can't control. I can't control it. I might as well shoot.
I was a little bit similar in that sense. We were, but he was so special. Honestly, he was so special. But I think it broke his heart that I won the Golden Boot in 1986 in his country, which he said, yeah. I said, you were the best, man. You were the best. He said, yeah, but you did it in my country. You did it in my country. I think that's quite hard on him, that World Cup, because it didn't really happen for him. But he wasn't playing a side that was as good as Real Madrid there.
No. I remember that World Cup really, really clearly. The build-up to it, the sense that this is going to be his moment. And it just wasn't. And you know, he didn't even score Mexico's best goal, because, of course, Negrete got that one. That was a proper bicycle kick.
I'm going to leave it there. Gary, thank you very much for joining us. It's been great to speak to you about El Clásico, Barcelona, Hugo Sanchez, you know, fantastic. Thanks very much for talking to us.
Absolute pleasure. I'm looking forward to El Clásico at the weekend, and I fear the worst a bit. I mean, I think Barcelona got some really special kids, but it's a big ask to go there, particularly after that defeat. Obviously, we're recording this just before Real Madrid play Manchester City. It's after the first leg, 3-3, so it'll be an interesting one. I will be cheering Manchester City out on, actually, obviously, because as a Barcelona man, as will every Barcelona fan. That's going to be a great game. Can't wait to watch it. And then the Clásico at the weekend. So if Real Madrid lose, then both teams will go into it in a bit of a downer. But if there's any game that it doesn't matter what's happened before, it's El Clásico.
Let me just throw that last one at you then, seeing as you've brought it up. So there's some really special players coming through at Barcelona. How good do you think Lamine Yamal can be?
I mean, so how do you say how good? I think he can be an absolutely world-class player. I think he's got incredible ability. I mean, the way he ghosted past a couple of players, it was for the first goal, wasn't it, in the Champions League against PSG before it all went tits up with Araujo's red card. I still think the keeper might have got that touch. I don't know. But anyway, alas. I think he's super special, massively talented. But there's a few of them. Kubasi, by the way. I mean, really? I mean, how good is he? It's like mad, because we kind of... You know, Lamine Yamal, young, he's what, 16, 17. Kubasi's kind of the same age as him. But you kind of expect it from the players with the talent, and they can do things. But a player with the responsibility of playing at the back, it's different. It's different. But boy, oh boy, they do produce some talent. And then Pedri and Gavi. So I think there's definitely better times to come at Barcelona, because they've got some incredible, I think, generational talent, but Yamal's one of them, but Kubasi, I can't remember ever seeing a central defender come in that good at that young.
The last one I can think of, to be honest, is Sergio Ramos, but even that's not really true, because he was a right back. I think he might have been just turned 18, and he was obviously kind of a force of personality as much as anything else when he first came in. But as I say, it sort of doesn't count, because he was a right back, not a centre back.
It's very rare. I mean, Piqué had to go off to Manchester United to learn a little bit, didn't he, in the early days? I can't think of anyone. Rio Ferdinand was brilliant as a youngster, but you know, he learnt a bit at West Ham, but coming into Barcelona at that age and absolutely bossing it and breaking the lines and bursting, I think he could be something really special. I always hate to say these things, because you're always terrified of jinxing someone, but you know, given a fair run, and if he's, which he clearly has got the right attitude and stuff, then the sky's the limit for him, Lamine Yamal and Kubasi. I love them both.
Well, we'll see what happens in the Clásico this weekend. And yeah, it might be conditioned by what happens in Real Madrid, Manchester City. So we'll all go off and watch that, and then we'll watch the Clásico this weekend. So, Gary, thanks again for joining us. It's been great, and speak soon.
Cheers to you both.
Network.